Yasna had rejected the nice rooms with balconies on the rim of Urethiru. Those had such an obvious entrance for assassins or spies. Her small room at the center of Dalinar's section was far more secure. She had stuffed the ventilation openings with cloth. The airflow from the hallway outside was adequate for this room, and she wanted to make sure nobody could overhear her by listening through the shafts. In the corner of her room, three span reeds worked tirelessly. She had rented them at great expense until she could acquire new ones of her own. They were paired with reeds in Tushik that had been delivered to one of the finest and most trustworthy information centers in the princedom. There, miles and miles away, a scribe was carefully rewriting each page of her notes, which she had originally sent to them to keep safe. "This speaker, Yasna," Ivory said, tapping the sheet she'd just read. Ivory had a clipped, no-nonsense voice. "This one who said these words. This person is a herald. Our suspicions are true. The heralds are, and the fallen one still is."
"We need to find him," Yasna said.
"We must search Shadesmar," Ivory said. "In this world, men can hide easily, but their souls shine out to us on the other side.
Unless someone knows how to hide them."
Ivory looked toward the growing stack of notes in the corner. One of the pens had finished writing. Yasna rose to change the paper. Shallan had rescued one of her trunks of notes, but two others had gone down with the sinking ship. Fortunately, Yasna had sent off these backup copies. Or did it matter? This sheet, encrypted by her cipher, contained lines and lines of information connecting the parchment to the Voidbringers. Once, she'd slaved over each of these passages, teasing them from history. Now their contents were common knowledge. In one moment, all of her expertise had been wiped away.
"We've lost so much time," she said.
"Yes. We must catch what we have lost, Yasna."
"We must."
"The enemy?" Yasna asked. "He stirs. He angers." Ivory shook his head, kneeling beside her as he changed the sheets of paper. "We are not before him, Yasna. He would destroy my kind and yours." The span reed finished, and another started writing out the first lines of her memoirs, which she'd worked on intermittently throughout her life. She'd thrown aside a dozen different attempts, and as she read this latest one, she found herself disliking it as well. "What do you think of Shallan?" she asked Ivory, shaking her head. "The person she's become." Ivory frowned, lips drawing tight. His sharply chiseled features, too angular to be human, were like those of a roughed-out statue the sculptor had neglected to finish.
"She is troubling," he said. "That much hasn't changed. She is not stable."
"Ivory, you think all humans are unstable."
"Not you," he said, lifting his chin. "You are like a spren. You think by facts. You change not on simple whims. You are as you are."
She gave him a flat stare.
"Mostly," he added. "Mostly. But it is, Yasna. Compared to other humans, you are practically a stone."
She sighed, standing up and brushing past him, returning to her writing desk. The herald's ravings glared at her. She settled down, feeling tired.
"Yasna," Ivory asked, "am I in error?"
"I am not so much a stone as you think, Ivory. Sometimes I wish I were."
"These words trouble you," he said, stepping up to her again and resting his jet-black fingers on the paper. "Why? You have read many troubling things."
Yasna settled back, listening to the three span reeds scratching paper, writing out notes that, she feared, would mostly be irrelevant. Something stirred deep within her. Glimmers of memory from a dark room, screaming her voice ragged. A childhood illness nobody else seemed to remember for all it had done to her. It had taught her that people she loved could still hurt her. Have you ever wondered how it would feel to lose your sanity, Ivory? Ivory nodded.
I have wondered at this. How could I not? Considering what the ancient fathers are.
You call me logical, whispered Yasna. It's untrue, as I let my passions rule me as much as many. In my times of peace, however, my mind has always been the one thing I could rely upon. Except once.
She shook her head, picking up the paper again.
I fear losing that, Ivory. It terrifies me.
How would it have felt to be these heralds? To suffer your mind slowly becoming untrustworthy? Are they too far gone to know? Or are there lucid moments where they strain and sort through memories, trying frantically to decide which are reliable and which are fabrications? She shivered.
The ancient ones, Ivory said again, nodding.
He didn't often speak of the Spren who had been lost during the recreants. Ivory and his fellows had been mere children, well, the Spren equivalent at the time. They spent years, centuries, with no older Spren to nurture and guide them. The Ink Spren were only now beginning to recover the culture and society they had lost when men abandoned their vows.
Your ward, Ivory said, her Spren, a cryptic.
Which is bad? Ivory nodded. He preferred simple, straightforward gestures. You never saw Ivory shrug.
Cryptics are trouble. They enjoy lies, Yasna. Feast upon them. Speak one word untrue at a gathering and seven cluster around you. Their humming fills your ears.
Have you warred with them?
One does not war with cryptics, as one does honor Spren. Cryptics have but one city, and do not wish to rule more, only to listen.
He tapped the table.
Perhaps this one is better with the bond.
Ivory was the only new generation Ink Spren to form a radiant bond. Some of his fellows would rather have killed Yasna instead of letting him risk what he had done. The Spren had a noble air about him, stiff-backed and commanding. He could change his size at will, but not his shape, except when fully in this realm, manifesting as a shard blade. He had taken the name Ivory as a symbol of defiance. He was not what his kin said he was, and would not suffer what fate proclaimed. The difference between a higher Spren like him and a common emotion Spren was in their ability to decide how to act, a living contradiction. Like human beings.
Shallan won't listen to me any longer, Yasna said. She rebels against every little thing I tell her. These last few months on her own have changed the child.
She never obeyed well, Yasna. That is who she is. In the past, at least, she pretended to care about my teaching. But you have said more humans should question their places in life. Did you not say that they too often accept presumed truth as fact?
She tapped the table.
You're right, of course. Wouldn't I rather have her straining against her boundaries as opposed to happily living within them? Whether she obeys me or not is of little import. But I do worry about her ability to command her situation, rather than letting her impulses command her.
How do you change this, if it is?
An excellent question. Yasna searched through the papers on her small table. She'd been collecting reports from her informants in the war camps, the ones who had survived, about Shallan. She'd truly done well in Yasna's absence. Perhaps what the child needed was not more structure, but more challenges.
All 10 orders are again, Ivory said from behind her.
For years it had been only the two of them, Yasna and Ivory. Ivory had been dodgy about giving odds on whether the other sapient Spren would refound their orders or not. However, he'd always said that he was certain that the Honor Spren, and therefore the Wind Runners, would never return,
Their attempts to rule Shadesmar had apparently not endeared them to the other races.
10 orders, Jasnah said. All ended in death.
All but one, Ivory agreed. They lived in death instead.
She turned around, and he met her eyes with his own. No pupils, just oil shimmering above something deeply black.
We must tell the others what we learned from Wit, Ivory. Eventually this secret must be known.
Jasnah, no! It would be the end. Another recreance.
The truth has not destroyed me.
You are special. No knowledge is that can destroy you, but the others.
She held his eyes, then gathered the sheets stacked beside her.
We shall see, she said,
then carried them to the table to bind them into a book.
48. Rhythm of Work. But we stand in the sea, pleased with our domains. Leave us alone. Moash grunted as he crossed the uneven ground, hauling a thick, knotted cord over his shoulder. Turned out the Voidbringers had run out of wagons. Too many supplies to bring and not enough vehicles. At least, vehicles with wheels. Moash had been assigned to a sledge, a cart with broken wheels that had been repurposed with a pair of long steel skids. They'd put him first in the line, pulling their rope. The Parshman overseers had considered him the most enthusiastic. Why wouldn't he be? The caravans moved at the slow pace of the Chulls, which pulled roughly half the ordinary wagons. He had sturdy boots and even a pair of gloves. Compared to bridge duty, this was a paradise. The scenery was even better. Central Alethkar was far more fertile than the shattered plains, and the ground sprouted with rock buds and the gnarled roots of trees. The sledge bounced and crunched over these, but at least he didn't have to carry the thing on his shoulders. Around him, hundreds of men pulled wagons or sledges piled high with foodstuffs, freshly cut lumber, or leather made from hog's hide or eel's skin. Some of the workers had collapsed on their first day out of Revelar. The Voidbringers had separated these into two groups. The ones who had tried, but were genuinely too weak, had been sent back to the city. A few deemed to be faking had been whipped, then moved to sledges instead of wagons. Harsh, but fair. Indeed, as the march continued, Moash was surprised at how well the human workers were treated. Though strict and unforgiving, the Voidbringers understood that to work hard, slaves needed good rations and plenty of time at night to rest. They weren't even chained up. Running away would be pointless under the watchful care of Fused, who could fly. Moash found himself enjoying these weeks hiking and pulling his sledge. It exhausted his body, quieted his thoughts, and let him fall into a calm rhythm. This was certainly far better than his days as a Light Eyes, when he'd worried incessantly about the plot against the king. It felt good just to be told what to do. What happened at the Shattered Plains wasn't my fault, he thought as he hauled the sledge. I was pushed into it. I can't be blamed. These thoughts comforted him. Unfortunately, he couldn't ignore their apparent destination. He'd walked this path dozens of times, running caravans with his uncle, even when he'd been a youth. Across the river, straight southeast, over Ishar's field and cutting past the town of Inkwell. The Voidbringers were marching to take Kolinar. The caravan included tens of thousands of Parshmen armed with axes or spears. They wore what Moash now knew was called war form, a Parshmen form with carapace armor and a strong physique. They weren't experienced, watching their nightly training told them they were basically the equivalent of Dark Eyes scrounged from villages and pressed into the army. But they were learning, and they had access to the Fused. Those zipped through the air or strode along beside carts, powerful and imperious, and surrounded by dark energy. There seemed to be different varieties, but each was intimidating. Everything was converging on the capital. Should that bother him? After all, what had Kolinar ever done for him? It was the place where his grandparents had been left to die, cold and alone in a prison cell. It was where the blighted King Elokar had danced and connived while good people rotted. Did humankind even deserve this kingdom? During his youth, he'd listened to traveling Ardents who accompanied the caravans. He knew that long ago humankind had won. A Hariatiam, the final confrontation with the Voidbringers, had happened thousands of years ago. What had they done with that victory? They'd set up false gods in the form of men whose eyes reminded them of the Night's Radiant. The life of men over the centuries had been nothing more than a long string of murders, wars, and thefts. The Voidbringers had obviously returned because men had proven they couldn't govern themselves. That was why the Almighty had sent this scourge. Indeed, the more he marched, the more Moash admired the Voidbringers. The armies were efficient, and the troops learned quickly. The caravans were well supplied. When an overseer saw that Moash's boots were looking worn, he had a new pair by evening. Each wagon or sledge was given 2 parchment overseers, but these were told to use their whips sparingly. They were quietly trained for the position, and Moash heard the occasional conversation between an overseer, once a parchman slave, and an unseen spren who gave them directions. The Voidbringers were smart, driven, and efficient. If Kolinar fell to this force, it would be no more than humankind deserved. Yes, perhaps the time for his people had passed. Moash had failed Kaladin and the others, but that was merely how men were in this debased age. He couldn't be blamed. He was a product of his culture. Only one oddity marred his observations. The Voidbringers seemed so much better than the human armies he'd been part of, except for one thing. There was a group of parchment slaves. They pulled one of the sledges and always walked apart from the humans. They wore work form, not war form, though otherwise they looked exactly like the other parchmen, with the same marbled skin. Why did this group pull a sledge? At first, as Moash plodded across the endless plains of central Alethkar, he found the sight of them encouraging. It suggested that the Voidbringers could be egalitarian. Maybe there'd simply been too few men with the strength to pull these sledges. Yet if that were so, why were these parchmen sledge pullers treated so poorly? The overseers did little to hide their disgust and were allowed to whip the poor creatures without restriction. Moash rarely glanced in their direction without finding one of them being beaten, yelled at, or abused. Moash's heart wrenched to see and hear this. Everyone else seemed to work so well together. Everything else about the army seemed so perfect. Except this. Who were these poor souls? The overseer called a break, and Moash dropped his rope, then took a long pull on his water skin. It was their 21st day of marching, which he only knew because some of the other slaves kept track. He judged the location as several days past Inkwell, in the final stretch toward Kolinar. He ignored the other slaves and settled down in the shade of the sledge, which was piled high with cut timber. Not far behind them, a village burned. There hadn't been anyone in it, as word had run before them. Why had the Voidbringers burned it, but not others they'd passed? Perhaps it was to send a message. Indeed, that smoke trail was ominous. Or perhaps it was to prevent any potential flanking armies from using the village. As his crew waited, Moash didn't know their names and hadn't bothered to ask, the parchment crew trudged past, bloodied and whipped, their overseers yelling them onward. They'd lagged behind. Pervasive cruel treatment led to a tired crew, which in turn led them to being forced to march to catch up when everyone else got a water break. That, of course, only wore them out and caused injuries, which made them lag farther behind, which made them get whipped. That's what happened to Bridge 4 back before Kaladin, Moash thought. Everyone said we were unlucky, but it was just a self-perpetuating downward spiral. Once that crew passed, trailing a few exhaustion spren, one of Moash's overseers called for his team to take up their ropes and get moving again. She was a young parsh woman with dark red skin, marbled only slightly with white. She wore a hava. Though it didn't seem like marching clothing, she wore it well. She had even done up the sleeve to cover her safe hand. "What'd they do, anyway?" he said as he took up his rope. "What was that?" she asked, looking back at him. Storms. Save for that skin and the odd sing-song quality to her voice, she could have been a pretty Makabaki caravan girl. "That parchment crew," he said. "What do they do to deserve such rough treatment?" He didn't actually expect an answer, but the parsh woman followed his gaze, then shook her head. "They harbored the false god, brought him into the very center among us." "The Almighty?" She laughed. "A real false god, a living one, like our living gods." She looked up as one of the fused passed overhead. "There are lots who think the Almighty is real," Moash said. "If that's the case, why are you pulling a sledge?" She snapped her fingers, pointing. Moash picked up his rope, joining the other men in a double line. They merged with the enormous column of marching feet, scraping sledges and rattling wheels. The Parshendi wanted to arrive at the next town before an impending storm. They'd weathered both types, High Storm and Everstorm, sheltering in villages along the way. Moash fell into the steady rhythm of the work. It wasn't long until he was sweating. He'd grown accustomed to the colder weather in the east near the Frostlands. It was strange to be in a place where the sun felt hot on his skin, and now the weather here was turning toward summer. His sledge soon caught up to the parchment crew. The two sledges walked side by side for a time, and Moash liked to think that keeping pace with his crew could motivate the poor parchman. Then one of them slipped and fell, and the entire team lurched to a stop. The whipping began. The cries, the crack of leather on skin. "That's enough." Moash dropped his rope and stepped out of the line. His shocked overseers called after him but didn't follow. Perhaps they were too surprised. He strode up to the parchment sledge where the slaves were struggling to pull themselves back up and start again. Several had bloodied faces and backs. The large parchman who had slipped lay curled on the ground. His feet were bleeding. No wonder he'd had trouble walking. Two overseers were whipping him. Moash seized one by the shoulder and pushed him back. "Stop it!" he snapped, then shoved the other overseer aside. "Don't you see what you're doing? You're becoming like us!" The two overseers stared at him, dumbfounded. "You can't abuse each other," Moash said. "You can't!" He turned toward the fallen parchman and extended a hand to help him up. But from the corner of his eye, he saw one of the overseers raise his arm. Moash spun and caught the whip that cracked at him, snatching it from the air and twisting it around his wrist to gain leverage. Then he yanked it, pulling the overseer stumbling toward him. Moash smashed a fist into his face, slamming him backward to the ground. "Storms, that hurt!" He shook his hand, which had clipped carapace on the side as he'd connected. He glared at the other overseer, who yelped and dropped his whip, jumping backward. Moash nodded once, then took the fallen slave by the arm and pulled him upright. "Ride in the sledge. Heal those feet." He took the parchment slave's place in line and pulled the rope taut over his shoulder. By now, his own overseers had gathered their wits and chased after him. They conferred with the two that he'd confronted, one nursing a bleeding cut around his eye. Their conversation was hushed, urgent, and punctuated by intimidated glances toward him. Finally, they decided to let it be. Moash pulled the sledge with the parchman, and they found someone to replace him on the other sledge. For a while, he thought more would come of it. He even saw one of the overseers conferring with a fused. But they didn't punish him. No one dared to again raise a whip against the parchment crew the rest of the march. 49. Born Unto Light. 23 years ago. Dalinar pressed his fingers together, then rubbed them, scraping the dry red-brown moss against itself. The scratchy sound was unpleasantly similar to that of a knife along bone. He felt the warmth immediately like an ember. A thin plume of smoke rose from his calloused fingers and struck below his nose, then parted around his face. Everything faded. The raucous sound of too many men in one room, the musky smell of their bodies pressed together. Euphoria spread through him like sudden sunlight on a cloudy day. He released a protracted sigh. He didn't even mind when Bashan accidentally elbowed him. Most places, being High Prince, would have won him a bubble of space, but at the stained wooden table in this poorly lit den, social standing was irrelevant. Here, with a good drink and a little help pressed between his fingers, he could finally relax. Here, nobody cared how presentable he was or if he drank too much. Here, he didn't have to listen to reports of rebellion and imagine himself out on those fields solving problems the direct way, sword in hand, thrill in his heart. He rubbed the moss more vigorously. Don't think about war, just live in the moment, as Evie always said. Havar returned with drinks. The lean, bearded man studied the overcrowded bench, then set the drinks down and hauled a slumped drunk out of his spot. He squeezed in beside Bashan. Havar was light-eyed, good family, too. He'd been one of Dalinar's elites back when that had meant something, though now he had his own land and a high commission. He was one of the few who didn't salute Dalinar so hard you could hear it. Bashan, though. Well, Bashan was an odd one. Dark-eyed of the first none, the portly man had traveled half the world and encouraged Dalinar to go with him to see the other half. He still wore that stupid wide-brimmed floppy hat. Havar grunted, passing down the drinks.
Squeezing in beside you, Bashan, would be far easier if you didn't have a gut that stretched to next week.
Just trying to do my duty, Bright Lord.
Your duty?
Light eyes need folks to obey them, right? I'm making certain that you got lots to serve you, at least by weight.
Dalinar took his mug but didn't drink. For now, the fire moss was doing its job. His wasn't the only plume rising in the dim stone chamber. Gavilar hated the stuff, but then Gavilar liked his life now. In the center of the dim room, a pair of parshmen pushed tables aside, then started setting diamond ships on the floor. Men backed away, making space for a large ring of light. A couple of shirtless men pushed their way through the crowd. The room's general air of clumsy conversation turned to one of roaring excitement.
"Are we going to bet?" Havar asked.
"Sure," Bashan replied. "I'll put these three garnet marks on the shorter one."
"I'll take that bet," Havar said. "But not for the money. If I win, I want your hat."
"Deal! Ha! So you're finally going to admit how dashing it is?"
"Dashing? Storms, Bashan. I'm going to do you a favor and burn the thing."
Dalinar sat back, mind dulled by the fire moss.
"Burn my hat," Bashan said. "Storms, Havar. That's harsh. Just because you envy my dashing profile.
The only thing dashing about that hat is how it makes women run the other way.
It's exotic. From the West. Everyone knows fashion comes from the West.
Yeah. From Leofor and Yezir. Where did you get that hat again?"
"The Pure Lake. Ah, that bastion of culture and fashion. Are you going shopping in Bavland next?" "Barmaids don't know the difference," Bashan grumbled. "Anyway, can we just watch the match? I'm looking forward to winning those marks off you."
He took a drink, but fingered his hat anxiously. Dalinar closed his eyes. He felt as if he could drift off. Maybe get some sleep without worrying about Evie or dreaming of war. In the ring, bodies smacked against each other. That sound, the grunts of exertion as the wrestlers tried to push each other from the ring, reminded him of the battle. Dalinar opened his eyes, dropped the moss, and leaned forward. The shorter wrestler danced out of the other's grip. They revolved around one another, crouched, hands at the ready. When they locked again, the shorter man pushed his opponent off balance.
"Better stance," Dalinar thought. "Kept himself low. That taller fellow has gotten by too long on his strength and size. He's got terrible form."
The two strained, backing toward the edge of the ring before the taller man managed to trip them both. Dalinar stood up as others ahead of him raised their hands and cheered.
The contest, the fight, that led me to almost kill Gavilar.
Dalinar sat back down. The shorter man won. Havar sighed, but rolled a few glowing spheres to Bashan.
Double or nothing on the next bout?
Nah, Bashan said, hefting the marks. It should be enough.
For what?
To bribe a few influential young dandies into trying hats like mine, Bashan said. I tell you, once word gets out, everyone is going to be wearing them.
You're an idiot.
So long as I'm a fashionable one.
Dalinar reached to the floor and picked up the fire moss. He tossed it onto the table and stared at it, then took a pull from his mug of wine. The next wrestling match started, and he winced as the two competitors collided. Storms, why did he keep putting himself into situations like this?
Dalinar, Havar said. Any word yet on when we're going to the Rift?
The Rift? Bashan asked. What about it?
Are you dense? Havar said.
No, Bashan said. But I might be drunk. What's up with the Rift?
Rumor is they want to set up their own High Prince, Havar said.
Son of the Old One. What was his name?
Tanalon,
Dalinar said.
But we're not going to be visiting the Rift, Havar.
Surely the king can't...
We won't be going, Dalinar said. You've got men to train and I...
Dalinar drank more wine.
I'm going to be a father. My brother can handle the Rift with diplomacy.
Havar leaned back, flippantly dropping his mug to the table.
The king can't politic his way past open rebellion, Dalinar.
Dalinar closed his fist around the fire moss, but didn't rub it. How much of his interest in the Rift was his duty to protect Gavilar's kingdom, and how much was his craving to feel the thrill again?
Damnation.
He felt like half a man these days. One of the wrestlers had shoved the other from the ring, disturbing the line of lights. The loser was declared, and a parchment carefully reset the ring. As he did so, a master servant stepped up to Dalinar's table.
Pardon, bright lord, he whispered, but you should know. The feature match will have to be cancelled.
What?
Bashan said.
What's wrong? Mark isn't going to fight?
Pardon, the master servant repeated, but his opponent has stomach problems. The match must be cancelled.
Apparently, news was spreading through the room. The crowd manifested their disapproval with boos and curses, shouts, and spilled drinks. A tall, bald man stood at the side of the ring, bare-chested. He argued with several of the light-eyed organizers, pointing at the ring, anger spren boiling on the floor around him. To Dalinar, this racket sounded like the calls of battle. He closed his eyes and breathed it in, finding a euphoria far superior to the fire moss.
Storms. He should have gotten drunker. He was going to slip.
Might as well be quick about it, then. He tossed aside the fire moss and stood, then pulled off his shirt.
Dalinar,
Havar said.
What are you doing?
Gavilar says I need to have more concern for our people's sorrows,
Dalinar said, stepping up onto the table.
Seems like we've got a room full of sorrow here.
Havar gaped, jaw dropping.
Bet on me, Dalinar said. For old time's sake.
He leaped off the table on the other side, then shoved through the crowd.
Someone tell that man he has a challenger.
Silence spread from him like a bad smell. Dalinar found himself at the edge of the ring in a completely quiet room, packed with once rowdy men, both light-eyed and dark. The wrestler, Mach, stepped back, his dark green eyes wide, anger spren vanishing. He had a powerful build, arms that bulged like they were overstuffed. Word was he'd never been defeated.
Well, Dalinar said, you wanted a fight, and I need a workout.
Bright lord, the man said,
this was to be a free-form bout. All hits and holds allowed.
Excellent,
Dalinar said.
What? You worried about injuring your high prince? I promise you clemency for anything done to me.
Hurting you?
The man said.
Storms, that's not what I'm afraid of.
He shivered visibly, and a Thalen woman, perhaps his manager, smacked him on the arm. She thought he'd been rude. The wrestler only bowed and backed away. Dalinar turned about the room, confronted by a sea of faces that suddenly seemed very uncomfortable. He'd broken some kind of rule here. The gathering dissolved, Parshman retrieving spheres from the ground. It seemed Dalinar had been too hasty to judge rank unimportant here. They'd suffered him as an observer, but he was not to participate. Damnation! He growled softly as he stalked to his bench, those anger spren following him on the floor. He took his shirt from Bashan with a swipe of the hand. Back with his elites, any man, from the lowest spearmen to the highest captains, would have sparred or wrestled with him. Storms he'd faced the cook several times, much to the amusement of everyone involved. He sat down and pulled on his shirt, stewing. He'd ripped the buttons free in removing it so quickly. The room fell silent as people continued to leave, and Dalinar just sat there, tense, his body still expecting the fight that would never come. No thrill. Nothing to fill him. Soon he and his friends were alone in the room, surveying empty tables, abandoned cups, and spilled drinks. The place somehow smelled even worse now than it had when crowded with men.
"Probably for the best, Bright Lord," Havar said. "I want to be among soldiers again, Havar," Dalinar whispered. "I want to be marching again. Best sleep a man can get is after a long march. And damnation, I want to fight! I want to face someone who won't pull their punches because I'm a high prince." "Then let's find such a fight, Dalinar," Havar said. "Surely the king will let us go. If not to the Rift, then to Herdaz or one of the Isles. We can bring him land, glory, honor." "That wrestler," Dalinar said. "There was something to his words. He was certain I would hurt him." Dalinar drummed his fingers on the table. "Was he scared off because of my reputation in general, or is there something more specific?"
Bashan and Havar shared a look.
"When?" Dalinar asked. "Tavern fight," Havar said. "2 weeks back. Do you remember it?"
Dalinar remembered a haze of monotony broken by light, a burst of color in his life. Emotion. He breathed out.
"You told me everyone was fine."
"They lived," Havar said.
"One of the brawlers you fought will never walk," Bashan admitted. "Another had to have his arm removed. A third babbles like a child. His brain doesn't work anymore." "That's far from fine," Dalinar snapped.
"Pardon, Dalinar," Havar said. "But when facing the Blackthorn, that's as good as one can expect." Dalinar crossed his arms on the table, grinding his teeth. The fire moss wasn't working. Yes, it gave him a quick rush of euphoria, but that only made him want the greater headiness of the thrill. Even now, he felt on edge. He had the urge to smash this table and everything in the room. He'd been so ready for the fight. He'd surrendered to the temptation, and then had the pleasure stolen from him. He felt all the shame of losing control, but none of the satisfaction of actually getting to fight. Dalinar seized his mug, but it was empty. Stormfather. He threw it and stood up, wanting to scream. He was fortunately distracted by the back door to the wrestling den, inching open, revealing a familiar pale face. Toe wore Alethi clothing now, one of the new suits that Gavilar preferred, but it fit him poorly. He was too spindly. No man would ever mistake Toe, with that overcautious gait and wide-eyed innocence, for a soldier.
"Dalinar?"
he asked, looking over the spilled drinks and the locked sphere lamps on the walls.
"The guards said I could find you here. Was this a party?"
"Ah, Toe," Havar said, lounging back in his seat. "How could it have been a party without you?"
Toe's eyes flicked toward the chunk of fire moss on the ground nearby.
"I'll never understand what you see in these places, Dalinar."
"'He's just getting to know the common people, Bright Lord,'
Bashan said, pocketing the fire moss.
"'You know us dark-eyed types, always wallowing in depravity. "'We need good role models, too.'
He cut off as Dalinar raised his hand. He didn't need underlings to cover for him.
"'What is it, Toh?'
"'Oh,'
the Rearan man said.
"'They were going to send a messenger, but I wanted to deliver the news.' My sister, you see. It's a little early, but the midwives aren't surprised. They say it's natural when...
Dalinar gasped, like he'd been punched in the stomach. Early, midwives, sister. He charged for the door and didn't hear the rest of what Toh said. Evie looked like she'd fought in a battle. He'd seen that expression on the faces of soldiers many times. That sweaty brow, that half-dazed, drowsy look. Exhaustion spread like jets in the air. These were the mark of a person pushed past the limits of what they thought they could do. She bore a smile of quiet satisfaction, a look of victory. Dalinar pushed past doting surgeons and midwives, stepping up to Evie's bed. She held out a limp hand, her left hand, which was wrapped only in a thin envelope that ended at the wrist. It would have been a sign of intimacy to an Aleti, but Evie still preferred that hand.
"'The baby?'
he whispered, taking the hand.
"'A son. Healthy and strong.'
"'A son? I have a son?'
Dalinar dropped to his knees beside the bed.
"'Where is he?'
"'Being washed, my lord,' said one of the midwives. "'He will be returned shortly.'
"'Torn buttons,'
Evie whispered.
"'You've been fighting again, Dalinar?'
"'Just a small diversion.'
"'That's what you say each time.'
Dalinar squeezed her hand through the envelope, too elated to prickle at the chastisement.
"'You and Toh came here to Alethkar because you wanted someone to protect you. "'You sought out a fighter, Evie.'
She squeezed his hand back. A nurse approached with a bundle in her arms, and Dalinar looked up, stunned, unable to rise.
"'Now,' the woman said, "'many men are apprehensive at first when—'
She cut off as Dalinar found his strength and seized the child from her arms. He held the boy aloft in both hands, letting out a whooping laugh, glory spren bursting around him as golden spears.
"'My son!'
he said.
"'My lord,' the nurse said, "'be careful!'
"'He's a Kolin,' Dalinar said, cradling the child. "'He's made of hardy stuff.'
He looked down at the boy, who, red-faced, wiggled and thrashed with his tiny fists. He had shockingly thick hair, black and blonde mixed. Good coloring. Distinctive.
"'May you have your father's strength,'
Dalinar thought, rubbing the child's face with his finger.
"'And at least some of your mother's compassion, little one.'
Looking into that face— Swelling with joy, Dalinar finally understood. This was why Gavilar thought so much about the future, about Alethkar, about crafting a kingdom that would last. Dalinar's life so far had stained him crimson and thrashed his soul. His heart was so crusted over with Krem it might as well have been a stone. But this boy, he could rule the princedom, support his cousin the king, and live a life of honor.
"'His name, Bright Lord?'
asked Ishal, an aged ardent from the Devatory of Purity.
"'I would burn the proper glyph wards if it pleases you.'
"'Name,'
Dalinar said.
"'Eduda.
Light.' He glanced toward Ebi, who nodded in agreement.
"'Without a suffix, my lord? Edodan? Edodal?'
"'Lin,'
Dalinar whispered. Born unto.
Adolin.
A good name, traditional, full of meaning. With regret, Dalinar surrendered the child to the nurses who returned him to his mother, explaining that it was important to train the baby to suckle as soon as possible. Most in the room began to file out to offer privacy, and as they did, Dalinar caught sight of a regal figure standing at the back. How had he missed Gavilar there? Gavilar took him by the arm and gave him a good thump on the back as they left the chamber. Dalinar was so dazed he barely felt it. He needed to celebrate, buy drinks for every man in the army, declare a holiday, or just run through the city whooping for joy. He was a father.
"An excellent day," Gavilar said. "A most excellent day."
"How do you contain it?"
Dalinar said.
"This excitement."
Gavilar grinned.
"I let the emotion be my reward for the work I have done."
Dalinar nodded, then studied his brother.
"What?"
Dalinar said.
"Something is wrong."
"Nothing."
"Don't lie to me, brother.
I don't want to ruin your wonderful day."
"Wondering will ruin it more than anything you could say, Gavilar. Out with it."
The king mulled, then nodded toward Dalinar's den. They crossed the main chamber, passing furniture that was far too showy, colorful with floral patterns and plush cushions. Evie's taste was partially to blame, though it was also just life these days. His life was plush. The den was more to his liking. A few chairs, a hearth, a simple rug.
A cabinet with various exotic and potent wines, each in a distinctive bottle.
They were the type it was almost ashamed to drink, as it spoiled the display.
"It's your daughter," Dalinar guessed. "Her lunacy."
"Jasnah is fine and recovering."
"It's not that."
Gavilar frowned, his expression dangerous. He'd agreed to a crown, after much debate. Sunmaker hadn't worn one, and the history said Yzereza Elin refused them as well. But people did love symbols, and most Western kings wore crowns. Gavilar had settled upon a black iron circlet. The more Gavilar's hair grayed, the easier the crown was to see. A servant had set a fire in the hearth, though it was burning low, only a single flame spren crawling along the embers.
"I am failing," Gavilar said.
"What?"
"Rathalas, the rift."
"But I thought..."
"Propaganda," Gavilar said. "Intended to quiet critical voices in Kolinar. Tanalan is raising an army and settling into his fortifications. Worse, I think the other high princes are encouraging him. They want to see how I handle this."
He sneered.
"There's talk I've grown soft over the years."
"They're wrong."
Dalinar had seen it, these months living with Gavilar. His brother had not grown soft. He was still as eager for conquest as ever. He simply approached it differently. The clash of words, the maneuvering of princedoms into positions where they were forced to obey. The fire's embers seemed to pulse like a heartbeat.
"Do you ever wonder about the time when this kingdom was truly great, Dalinar?"
Gavilar asked.
"When people looked to the Alethi? When kings sought their advice? When we were radiant."
"Traitors,"
Dalinar said.
"Does the act of a single generation negate many generations of domination? We revere the Sunmaker when his reign lasted but the blink of an eye, yet we ignore the centuries the Radiance led. How many desolations did they defend mankind?"
The Ardents talked about this in prayers, didn't they? He tried to guess.
10?
"A meaningless number," Gavilar said, waving his fingers. "The histories just say 10 because it sounds significant. Either way, I have failed in my diplomatic efforts."
He turned toward Dalinar.
"It is time to show the kingdom that we are not soft, brother."
"Oh, no."
Hours ago, he would have leaped in excitement, but after seeing that child...
"You'll be anxious again in a few days," Dalinar told himself. "A man can't change in a moment." "Gavilar," he whispered, "I'm worried."
"You're still the Blackthorn, Dalinar."
"I'm not worried about whether I can win battles."
Dalinar stood, throwing back his chair in his haste. He found himself pacing.
"I'm like an animal, Gavilar. Did you hear about the bar fight? Storms, I can't be trusted around people."
"You are what the Almighty made you.
I'm telling you, I'm dangerous. Sure, I can crush this little rebellion, bathe Oathbringer in some blood. Great. Wonderful. Then what? I come back here and lock myself in a cage again?
I might have something that will help.
Bah. I've tried living a quiet life. I can't live through endless politics like you can. I need more than just words.
You've merely been trying to restrain yourself. You've tried casting out the bloodthirst, but you haven't replaced it with anything else. Go do what I command, then return and we can discuss further.
Dalinar stopped near his brother, then took a single purposeful step into his shadow.
Remember this. Remember you serve him.
He would never return to that place that had almost led him to attack this man.
When do I ride for the rift? Dalinar asked.
You don't. But you just said, I'm sending you to battle, but not against the rift. Our kingdom suffers threats from abroad. There is a new dynasty threatening us from Herdaz. A Reshi house has gained power there, and the Vaidens have been raiding Alethkar in the southwest. They're claiming it's bandits, but the forces are too organized. It's a test to see how we react.
Dalinar nodded slowly.
You want me to go fight on our borders? Remind everyone we're still capable of employing the sword.
Exactly. This is a dangerous time for us, brother. The High Prince's question. Is a united Alethkar worth the trouble? Why bow before a king?
Tanalan is the manifestation of their questions, but he has been careful not to stray into outright rebellion.
If you attack him, the other High Princes could unite behind the rebels. We could shatter the kingdom and have to start all over. I will not allow that. I will have a unified Alethkar. Even if I have to hit the High Princes so hard they are forced to melt together from the heat of it. They need to remember that. Go to Herdaz first, then Yakaved. Remind everyone why they fear you.
Gavilar met Dalinar's eyes. No, he was not soft. He thought like a king now. He sought the long term, but Gavilar Kholin was as determined as ever.
It will be done, Dalinar said. Storms this day had been a tempest of emotion.
Dalinar stalked toward the door. He wanted to see the child again.
Brother, Gavilar said.
Dalinar turned back and regarded Gavilar, who was bathed by the bleeding light of a fire reaching its end.
Words are important, Gavilar said. Much more than you give them credit for being.
Perhaps, Dalinar said.
But if they were all-powerful, you wouldn't need my sword, would you?
Perhaps. I can't help feeling words would be enough, if only I knew the right ones to say.
50. Shash 37. We also instruct that you should not return to Obra Dei. We have claimed that world, and a new avatar of our being is beginning to manifest there. She is young yet, and, as a precaution, she has been instilled with an intense and overpowering dislike of you. To Dalinar, flying felt much like being on a ship in the ocean. There was something profoundly disconcerting about being out on the ocean, subject to the winds and currents. Men didn't control the waves, they merely set out and prayed that the ocean didn't decide to consume them. Flying alongside Captain Kaladin provoked some of the same emotions in Dalinar. On one hand, the view over the shattered plains was magnificent. He felt he could almost see the pattern to it that Shallan mentioned. On the other hand, this kind of travel was deeply unnatural. Winds buffeted them, and if you moved your hands or arched your back in the wrong way, you were sent in a different direction from everyone else. Kaladin had to constantly zip back and forth, riding one of them that got blown off course. And if you looked down, and paused to consider exactly how high up you were? Well, Dalinar was not a timid man, but he was still glad of Navani's hand in his. On his other side flew Elokar, and beyond him were Kadash and a pretty young Ardent who served as one of Navani's scholars. The five of them were escorted by Kaladin and 10 of his squires. The Windrunners had been training steadily for 3 weeks now, and Kaladin had finally, after practicing by flying groups of soldiers back and forth to the war camps, agreed to treat Dalinar and the king to a similar trip.
It is like being on a ship, Dalinar thought.
What would it feel like to be up here during a high storm? That was how Kaladin planned to get Elokar's team to Kolinar, fly them at the leading edge of a storm so his stormlight was continually renewed.
You're thinking of me, the Stormfather said. I can feel it.
I'm thinking of how you treat ships, Dalinar whispered, his physical voice lost to the winds, yet his meaning carried unhampered to the Stormfather.
Men should not be upon the waters during a storm, he replied. Men are not of the waves.
And the sky? Are men of the sky?
Some are.
He said this grudgingly. Dalinar could only imagine how terrible it must be to be a sailor out at sea during a storm. He had taken only short coastwise trips by ship.
No, wait, he thought. There was one, of course. A trip to the valley.
He barely remembered that voyage, though he could not blame that solely upon the Night Watcher. Captain Kaladin swooped over. He was the only one who seemed truly in control of his flying. Even his men flew more like dropped rocks than sky eels. They lacked his finesse, his control. Though the others could help if something went wrong, Kaladin had been the only one lashing Dalinar and the others. He said he wanted practice for the eventual flight to Kolinar. Kaladin touched Elokar, and the king started to slow. Kaladin then moved down the line, slowing each in turn. He then swept them up so they were close enough to speak. His soldiers stopped and floated nearby.
What's wrong?
Dalinar asked, trying to ignore that he was hanging hundreds of feet in the sky.
Nothing's wrong, Kaladin said, then pointed.
With the wind in his eyes, Dalinar had failed to spot the war camps. 10 crater-like circles arrayed along the northwestern edge of the shattered plains. From up here, it was obvious they had once been domes, the way their walls curved, like cupping fingers from underneath. 2 of the war camps were still fully occupied, and Sabariel had set up forces to lay claim to the nearby forest. Dalinar's own war camp was less populated, but had a few platoons of soldiers and some workers.
We arrived so quickly, Navani said.
Her hair was a wind-tousled mess, much of it having escaped her careful braid. Elokar hadn't fared much better. His hair sprayed out from his face like waxed Thalen eyebrows. The 2 Ardents, of course, were bald and didn't have such worries.
Quick indeed, Elokar said, redoing a few buttons of his uniform. This is most promising for our mission.
Yeah, Kaladin said. I still want to test it more in front of a storm.
He took the king by the shoulder, and Elokar started to drift downward. Kaladin sent them each down in turn, and when his feet finally touched stone again, Dalinar heaved a sigh of relief. They were only one plateau over from the war camp, where a soldier at a watchpost waved to them with eager, exaggerated movements. Within minutes, a troop of Kolin soldiers had surrounded them.
"Let's get you inside the walls, Bright Lord,"
their captain lord said, hand on the pommel of his sword.
The shell heads are still active out here.
Have they attacked this close to the camps? Elokar asked, surprised.
No, but that doesn't mean they won't, Your Majesty.
Dalinar wasn't so worried, but said nothing as the soldiers ushered him and the others into the war camp where Brightness Yasalai, the tall, stately woman Dalinar had put in charge of the camp, met and accompanied them. After spending so much time in the alien hallways of Urethiru, walking through this place, which had been Dalinar's home for 5 years, was relaxing. Part of that was finding the war camp mostly intact. It had weathered the Everstorm quite well. Most of the buildings were stone bunkers, and that western rim of the former dome had provided a solid windbreak.
My only worry, he told Yasalai after a short tour, is about logistics.
This is a long march from Narak and the Oathgate. I fear that by dividing our forces among Narak, here, and Urethiru, we're increasing our vulnerability to an attack.
That is true, Bright Lord, the woman said. I endeavor only to provide you with options.
Unfortunately, they would probably need this place for farming operations, not to mention the lumber. Plateau runs for gem hearts couldn't sustain the tower's city population forever, particularly in the face of Shallan's assessment that they had likely hunted chasm fiends near to extinction. Dalinar glanced at Navani. She thought they should found a new kingdom here, on and around the Shattered Plains. Import farmers, retire older soldiers, start production here on a much larger scale than they'd ever tried before. Others disagreed. There was a reason the unclaimed hills weren't densely inhabited. It would be a harsh life here. Rock buds grew smaller, crops would be less productive. And founding a new kingdom during a desolation? Better to protect what they had. Alethkar could probably feed Urethiru, but that depended on Kaladin and Elikar recovering the capital. Their tour ended with a meal at Dalinar's bunker, in his former sitting room, which looked bare now that most of the furniture and rugs had been removed to Urethiru. After the meal, he found himself standing by the window, feeling oddly out of place. He'd left this war camp only 10 weeks ago, but the place was at once deeply familiar and also no longer his. Behind him, Navani and her scribe ate fruit as they chatted quietly over some sketches that Navani had done.
"Oh, but I think that the others need to experience that brightness," the scribe said. "The flight was remarkable. How fast do you think we were going? I believe we might have attained a speed that no human has reached since the Recreants. Think about that, Navani. Surely we were faster than the fastest horse or ship."
"Focus, Rushu," Navani said. "My sketch."
"I don't think this math is right, Brightness. No, that sail will never stand."
"It's not meant to be completely accurate," Navani said. "Just a concept. My question is, can it work?"
"We'll need more reinforcement." "Yes, more reinforcement for certain. And then the steering mechanism, definitely work to do there. This is clever, though, Brightness. Falalar needs to see it. He will be able to say whether or not it can be built."
Dalinar glanced away from the window, catching Navani's eye. She smiled. She always claimed that she wasn't a scholar, but a patron of scholars. She said her place was to encourage and guide the real scientists. Anyone who saw the light in her eyes as she took out another sheet and sketched her idea further knew she was being too modest. She began another sketch, but then stopped and glanced to the side where she'd set out a span reed. The ruby was blinking.
"Fen," Dalinar thought.
The Queen of Thelena had asked that, in this morning's high storm, Dalinar send her into the vision of Ahare Etiam, which she knew about from the published accounts of Dalinar's visions. He'd reluctantly sent her alone, without supervision. They'd been waiting for her to speak of the event, to say anything. In the morning, she hadn't replied to their requests for a conversation. Navani prepared the span reed, then set it writing. It scribbled for only a brief moment.
"That was short," Dalinar said, stepping toward her.
"Only one word," Navani said.
She looked up at him.
"Yes."
Dalinar heaved out a long breath. She was willing to visit Urethiru.
Finally.
"Tell her we'll send her a radiant."
He left the window, watching as she replied. In her sketchpad, he caught sight of some kind of ship-like contraption, but with the sail on the bottom. What in the world? Fen seemed content to leave the conversation there, and Navani returned to her discussion of engineering, so Dalinar slipped from the room. He passed through his bunker, which felt hollow, like the rind of a fruit with the pulp scooped out. No servants scuttling back and forth, no soldiers. Kaladin and his men had gone off somewhere, and Kadash was probably at the camp monastery. He'd been keen to get there, and Dalinar had been gratified by his willingness to fly with Kaladin.
They hadn't spoken much since their confrontation in the sparring room. Well, perhaps seeing the Windrunner's power firsthand would improve Kadash's opinion of the Radiance. Dalinar was surprised, and secretly pleased, to find that no guards had been posted at the bunker's back door. He slipped out alone and headed to the War Camp Monastery. He wasn't looking for Kadash. He had another purpose. He soon arrived at the monastery, which looked like most of the war camp, a collection of buildings with the same smooth, rounded construction, crafted from the air by Alethi soulcasters. This place had a few small, hand-built buildings of cut stone, but they looked more like bunkers than places of worship. Dalinar had never wanted his people to forget that they were at war. He strolled through the campus and found that, without a guide, he didn't know his way among the nearly identical structures. He stopped in a courtyard between buildings. The air smelled of wet stone from the high storm, and a nice group of shellbark sculptures rose to his right, shaped like stacks of square plates. The only sound was water dripping from the eaves of the buildings. Storms, he should know his way around his own monastery, shouldn't he? How often did you actually visit here during all the years in the war camps? He'd meant to come more often and talk to the Ardents in his chosen devotary. There had always been something more pressing, and besides, the Ardents stressed that he didn't need to come. They had prayed and burned glyph wards on his behalf. That was why High Lords owned Ardents. Even during his darkest days of war, they'd assured him that, in pursuing his calling, by leading his armies, he served the Almighty. Dalinar stooped into a building that had been divided into many small rooms for prayers. He walked down a hallway until he stepped through a storm door into the atrium, which still smelled faintly of incense. It seemed insane that the Ardents would be angry with him now, after training him his whole life to do as he wished. But he'd upset the balance, rocked the boat. He moved among braziers filled with wet ash. Everyone liked the system they had. The Light Eyes got to live without guilt or burden, always confident that they were active manifestations of God's will. The Dark Eyes got free access to training in a multitude of skills. The Ardents got to pursue scholarship. The best of them lived lives of service. The worst lived lives of indolence. But what else were important light-eyed families going to do with unmotivated children? A noise drew his attention, and he left the courtyard and looked into a dark corridor. Light poured from a room at the other end, and Dalinar was not surprised to find Kadash inside. The Ardent was moving some ledgers and books from a wall safe into a pack on the floor. On a desk nearby, a span reed scribbled. Dalinar stepped into the room. The scarred Ardent jumped, then relaxed when he saw it was Dalinar. "Do we need to have this conversation again, Dalinar?" he asked, turning back to his packing. "No," Dalinar said. "I didn't actually come looking for you. I want to find a man who lived here, a madman who claimed to be one of the heralds." Kadash cocked his head. "Ah, yes. The one who had a shard blade? All of the other patients at the monastery are accounted for, safe at Urethiru, but he vanished somehow. I was hoping to see if his room offered any clues to what became of him." Kadash looked at him, gauging his sincerity. Then the Ardent sighed, rising. "That's a different devotary from mine," he said. "But I have occupancy records here. I should be able to tell you which room he was in." "Thank you." Kadash looked through a stack of ledgers. "Shash building," he finally said, pointing absently out the window. "That one right there, room 37. Insa ran the facility. Her records will list details of the madman's treatment. If her departure from the war camp was anything like mine, she'll have left most of her paperwork behind." He gestured toward the safe and his packing. "Thank you," Dalinar said. He moved to leave. "You think the madman was actually a herald, don't you?"
"I think it's likely."
He spoke with a rural Alethi accent, Dalinar. "And he looks Makabaki," Dalinar replied. "That alone is an oddity, wouldn't you say?" Immigrant families are not so uncommon. Ones with shard blades? Kadash shrugged.
Let's say I could actually find one of the heralds, Dalinar said. Let's say we could confirm his identity and you accepted that proof. Would you believe him if he told you the same things I have?
Kadash sighed.
Surely you'd want to know if the Almighty were dead, Kadash, Dalinar said, stepping back into the room. Tell me you wouldn't. You know what it would mean? It would mean there is no spiritual basis for your rule.
I know.
And the things you did in conquering Alethkar, Kadash said. No divine mandate, Dalinar. Everyone accepts what you did because your victories were proof of the Almighty's favor. Without him, then what are you?
Tell me, Kadash, would you really rather not know? Kadash looked at the span reed, which had stopped writing. He shook his head.
I don't know, Dalinar. It certainly would be easier. Isn't that the problem? What has any of this ever required of men like me? What has it required of any of us?
It required you to be what you are, which is self-fulfilling, Dalinar said.
You were a swordsman, Kadash. Would you have gotten better without opponents to face? Would you have gotten stronger without weights to lift? Well, in Boronism, we've spent centuries avoiding the opponents and the weights.
Again, Kadash glanced at the span reed.
What is it? Dalinar asked.
I left most of my span reeds behind, Kadash explained, when I went with you toward the center of the Shattered Plains. I took only the span reed linked to an ardent transfer station in Kolinar. I thought that would be enough, but it no longer works. I've been forced to use intermediaries in Tashik.
Kadash lifted a box onto the desk and opened it. Inside were 5 more span reeds with blinking rubies indicating that someone had been trying to contact Kadash.
These are links to the leaders of Voronism in Yarkaved, Herdaz, Karbranth, Thelana, and New Natnan, Kadash said, counting them off. They had a meeting via reeds today discussing the nature of the desolation in the Everstorm. And perhaps you. I mentioned I was going to recover my own span reeds today. Apparently their meeting has made them all very eager to question me further.
He let the silence hang between them, measured out by the 5 blinking red lights.
What of the one that is writing? Dalinar asked.
Aligned to the Palinaeum and the heads of Voron Research there. They've been working on the Dawn Chant using the clues Brightness Navani gave them from your visions. What they've sent me are relevant passages from ongoing translations.
Proof, Dalinar said. You wanted solid proof that what I've been seeing is real.
He strode forward, grabbing Kadash by the shoulders.
You waited for that reed first before answering the leaders of Voronism?
I wanted all the facts in hand.
So you know that the visions are real?
I long ago accepted that you weren't mad. These days it's more a question of who might be influencing you.
Why would the Voidbringers give me these visions? Dalinar said. Why would they grant us great powers like the one that flew us here? It's not rational, Kadash.
Neither is what you're saying about the Almighty. He held up a hand to cut off Dalinar.
I don't want to have this argument again. Before you asked me for proof that we are following the Almighty's precepts, right?
All I asked for and all I want is the truth.
We have it already. I'll show you.
I look forward to it, Dalinar said, walking to the door.
But Kadash, in my painful experience, the truth may be simple, but it is rarely easy.
Dalinar crossed to the next building over and counted down the rooms. Storms, this building felt like a prison. Most of the doors hung open, revealing uniformed chambers beyond. Each had one tiny window, a slab for a bed, and a thick wooden door. The Ardents knew what was best for the sick. They had access to all the world's latest research in all fields. But was it really necessary to lock madmen away like this? Number 37 was still bolted shut. Dalinar rattled the door, then threw his shoulder against it. Storms, it was thick. Without thinking, he put his hand to the side and tried summoning his shard blade. Nothing happened.
"What are you doing?"
the Stormfather demanded.
"Sorry,"
Dalinar said, shaking his hand out. "Habit." He crouched down and tried peeking under the door, then called out, suddenly horrified by the idea that they might have simply left the man in here to starve. That couldn't have happened, could it?
"My powers," Dalinar said, rising. "Can I use them?" "Binding things?" the Stormfather said. "How would that open a door? You are a bondsmith. You bring things together. You do not divide them."
"And my other surge," Dalinar said. "That radiant in the vision made stone warp and ripple."
"You are not ready. Besides, that surge is different for you than it is for a stone ward."
Well, from what Dalinar could see underneath the door, there seemed to be light in this room. Perhaps it had a window to the outside he could use. On his way out, he poked through the ardent chambers until he found an office like Kadash's. He didn't find any keys, though the desk still had pens and ink sitting on it. They'd left in haste, so there was a good chance the wall safe contained records. But of course, Dalinar couldn't get in. Storms, he missed having a shard blade. He rounded the outside of the building to check the window, then immediately felt silly for spending so much time trying to get through the door. Somebody else had already cut a hole in the stone out here, using the distinctive clean slices of a shard blade. Dalinar stepped inside, picking his way around the broken remnants of the wall which had fallen inward, indicating that the shard-bearer had cut from the outside. He found no madman. The Ardens had likely seen this hole and moved on with their evacuation. News of the strange hole must not have filtered up to the lead Ardens. He didn't find anything to indicate where the Herald had gone, but at least he knew a shard-bearer was involved. Someone powerful had wanted into this room, which lent even more credence to the madman's claims of being a Herald. So who had taken him? Or had they done something to him instead? What happened to a Herald's body when they died? Could someone else have come to the same conclusion that Jasnah had? As he was about to leave, Dalinar spotted something on the ground beside the bed. He knelt down, shooed away a kremling, and picked up a small object. It was a dart, green with yellow twine, wrapped around it. He frowned, turning it over in his fingers. Then he looked up as he heard someone distantly calling his name. He found Kaladin out in the monastery courtyard calling for him. Dalinar approached, then handed him the little dart.
"Ever seen anything like this before, Captain?"
Kaladin shook his head. He sniffed at the tip, then raised his eyebrows. "That's poison on the tip. Blackbane derived."
"Are you sure?"
Dalinar asked, taking the dart back.
"Very. Where did you find it?"
"In the chamber that housed the Herald." Kaladin grunted. "You need more time for your search?"
"Not much," Dalinar said. "Though it would help if you'd summon your shard blade."
A short time later, Dalinar handed Navani the records he'd taken from the Ardent's safe. He dropped the dart in a pouch and handed it over as well, warning her about the poisoned tip. One by one, Kaladin sent them into the sky, where his bridgemen caught them and used stormlight to stabilize them. Dalinar was last, and as Kaladin reached for him, he took the captain by the arm.
"You want to practice flying in front of a storm," Dalinar said. "Could you get to Thalana?"
"Probably," Kaladin said, "if I lashed myself southward as fast as I can go."
"Go then," Dalinar said. "Take someone with you to test flying another person in front of a storm if you want. But get to Thalan City. Queen Fenn is willing to join us, and I want that oath gate active. The world has been turning before our very noses, Captain. Gods and heralds have been warring, and we were too focused on our petty problems to even notice."
"I'll go next Highstone," Kaladin said, then sent Dalinar soaring up into the air. 51. Full Circle.
This is all we will say at this time. If you wish more, seek these waters in person and overcome the tests we have created. Only in this will you earn our respect. The Parshman of Moash's new sledge crew didn't like him. That didn't bother him. Lately, he didn't much like himself. He didn't expect or need their admiration. He knew what it felt like to be beaten down, despised. When you'd been treated as they had, you didn't trust someone like Moash. You asked yourself what he was trying to get from you. After a few days of pulling their sledge, the landscape began to change. The open plains became cultivated hills. They passed great sweeping wards, artificial stone ridges, built by planting sturdy wooden barricades to collect creme during storms. The creme would harden, slowly building up a mound on the stormward side. After a few years, you raise the top of the barricade. They took generations to grow to useful sizes, but here, around the oldest, most populated centers of Alethkar, they were common. They looked like frozen waves of stone, stiff and straight on the western side, sloping and smooth on the other side. In their shadows, vast orchards spread in rows, most of the trees cultivated to grow no more than the height of a man. The western edge of those orchards was ragged with broken trees. Barriers would need to be erected to the west as well now. He expected the fused to burn the orchards, but they didn't. During a water break, Moash studied one of them. A tall woman who hovered a dozen feet in the air, toes pointed downward. Her face was more angular than those of the Parshman. She resembled a spren the way she hung there, an impression accented by her flowing clothing. Moash leaned back against his sledge and took a pull on his water skin. Nearby, an overseer watched him and the Parshman of his crew. She was new, a replacement for the one he'd punched. A few more of the fused passed on horses, trotting the beasts with obvious familiarity. That variety doesn't fly, he thought. They can raise the darklight around themselves, but it doesn't give them lashings. Something else. He glanced back at the one nearest him, the one hovering. But that type almost never walks. It's the same kind that captured me. Kaladin wouldn't have been able to stay aloft as long as these did. He'd run out of stormlight. She's studying those orchards, Moash thought. She looks impressed. She turned in the air and soared off, long clothing rippling behind her. Those overlong robes would have been impractical for anyone else, but for a creature who almost always flew, the effect was mesmerizing. This isn't what I was supposed to be like, Moash said. Nearby, one of the Parshmen of his crew grunted.
Tell me about it, human.
Moash glanced at the man who had settled down in the shade of their lumber-laden sledge. The Parshman was tall, with rough hands, mostly dark skin, marbled with lines of red. The others had called him Sa, a simple Alethi Dark Eyes name. Moash nodded his chin toward the Voidbringers. They were supposed to sweep in relentlessly, destroying everything in their path. They are literally incarnations of destruction.
And? Saw asked.
And that one, Moash said, pointing toward the flying Voidbringer, is pleased to find these orchards here. They only burned a few towns. They seem intent on keeping Revelar working it. Moash shook his head. This was supposed to be an apocalypse, but you don't farm an apocalypse.
Saw grunted again.
He didn't seem to know any more about this than Moash did, but why should he? He'd grown up in a rural community in Alethkar. Everything he knew about history and religion, he'd have heard filtered through the human perspective.
You shouldn't speak so casually about the fused human, Sa said, standing up. They're dangerous.
Don't know about that, Moash said, as two more passed overhead. The one I killed went down easy enough, though I don't think she was expecting me to be able to fight back. He handed his waterskin to the overseer as she came around for them. Then he glanced at Saw, who was staring at him slack-jawed. Probably shouldn't have mentioned killing one of their gods, Moash thought, walking to his place in line, last, closest to the sledge, so he stared at a sweaty parchment back all day. They started up again, and Moash expected another long day's work. These orchards meant Kolinar itself was a little over a day's hike away at an easy pace. He figured the Voidbringers would push them hard to reach the capital by nightfall. He was surprised, then, when the army diverged from the direct route. They wove between some hillsides until they reached a town, one of the many suburbs of Kolinar. He couldn't recall the name. The tavern had been nice and welcoming to caravaneers. Clearly there were other Voidbringer armies moving through Alethkar, because they'd obviously seized this city days, if not weeks ago. Parshman patrolled it, and the only humans he saw were already working the fields. Once the army arrived, the Voidbringers surprised Moash again by selecting some of the wagon pullers and setting them free. They were the weaklings, the ones who had fared worst on the road. The overseers sent them trudging toward Kolinar, which was still too far off to see.
They're trying to burden the city with refugees, Moash thought. Ones that aren't fit to work or fight anymore.
The main bulk of the army moved into the large storm bunkers in this suburb. They wouldn't attack the city immediately. The Voidbringers would rest their armies, prepare, and besiege. In his youth, he'd wondered why there weren't any suburbs closer than a day's walk from Kolinar. In fact, there was nothing between its walls and here, only empty flats. Even the hills there had been mined down centuries ago. The purpose was clear to him now. If you wanted to lay siege to Kolinar, this was the closest you could put your army. You couldn't camp in the city's shadow. You'd be swept away by the first storm. In the town, the supply sledges were split, some sent down one street, which looked hauntingly empty to him, while his went down another. They actually passed the tavern he'd preferred, the Fallen Tower. He could see the glyph etched into the leeward stone. Finally, his crew was called to a halt, and he let go of the rope, stretching his hands and letting out a relieved sigh. They'd been sent to a large open ground near some warehouses where parchmen were cutting lumber. A lumber yard? He thought, then felt stupid. After hauling wood all this way, what else would he expect? Still, a lumber yard. Like those back in the war camps. He started laughing.
Don't be so jovial, human, spat one of the overseers. You're to spend the next few weeks working here, building siege equipment. When the assault happens, you'll be at the front, running a ladder toward Kolinar's infamous walls.
Moash laughed even harder. It consumed him, shook him. He couldn't stop. He laughed helplessly until, short of breath, he dizzily lay back on the hard stone ground, tears leaking down the sides of his face.
We have investigated this woman, Moraes' newest letter to Shallan read. Ishna has overinflated her importance to you. She was indeed involved in espionage for House Hammaradin, as she told you, but she was merely an assistant to the true spies. We have determined that she is safe to allow close to you, though her loyalties should not be trusted too far. If you eliminate her, we will help cover up the disappearance, at your request. But we have no objection to you retaining her services. Shallan sighed, settling back in her seat, where she waited outside King Elokar's audience chamber. She'd found this paper unexpectedly in her satchel. So much for hoping Ishna had information about the ghost bloods she could use. The letter practically boiled with possessiveness. They would allow Ishna to be close to her? Storms, they acted like they owned her already. She shook her head, then rummaged in her satchel, taking out a small sphere pouch. It would look unremarkable to anyone inspecting it, for they wouldn't know that she'd transformed it with a small but simple illusion. Though it appeared violet, it was actually white. The interesting thing about it was not the illusion itself, but how she was powering it. She'd practiced before with attaching an illusion to pattern, or to a location, but she'd always needed to power it with her own stormlight. This one, however, she'd attached to a sphere inside the pouch. She was going on 4 hours now with the light weaving needing no extra stormlight from her. She'd needed only to create it, then affix it to the sphere. Slowly, the light had been draining from the sapphire mark, just like a fabrial draining its gemstone. She'd even left the pouch alone in her rooms when going out, and the illusion had still been in place when she'd returned. This had begun as an experiment on how she could help Dalinar create his illusory maps of the world, then leave them for him without her having to remain in the meeting. Now, however, she was seeing all kinds of possible applications. The door opened, and she dropped the pouch back into her satchel. A master servant ushered a few merchants out of the king's presence. Then the servant bowed to Shallan, waving her in. She stepped hesitantly into the audience chamber, a room in Urethiru with a fine blue and green rug and stuffed with furniture. Diamonds shone from lamps, and Elokar had ordered the walls painted, obscuring the strata. The king himself, in a blue Kolin uniform, was unrolling a map onto a large table at the side of the room. "Was there another, Helt?" he asked the master servant. "I thought I was done for the—" He trailed off as he turned. "Brightness, Shallan! Were you waiting out there? You could have seen me immediately." "I didn't want to be a bother," Shallan said, stepping over to him as the master servant prepared refreshment. The map on the table showed Kolinar, a grand city, which seemed every bit as impressive as Vaidenar. Papers in a pile beside it looked to have the final reports from Spanreads in the city, and a wizened Ardent sat near them, ready to read for the king or take notes at his request. "I think we're almost ready," the king said, noting her interest. "The delay has been nearly insufferable, but requisite, I'm sure. Captain Kaladin did want to practice flying other people before bringing my royal person. I can respect that." "He's asked me to fly with him above the storm to Thalen City," Shallan said, "to open the Oath Gate there. He's overly worried about dropping people, but if he does that to me, I'll have stormlight of my own and should survive the fall."
"Excellent," Elokar said. "Yes, a fine solution. But then you didn't come here to talk about this. What is your request of me?"
"Actually," Shallan said, "could I talk to you in private for a moment, Your Majesty?" He frowned, but then ordered his people to step out into the hallway. When two guards from Bridge 13 hesitated, the king was firm.
"She's a knight radiant," he said. "What do you think is going to happen to me?"
They filed out, leaving the two of them beside Elokar's table. Shallan took a deep breath, then changed her face. Not to that of Vale or Radiant, not one of her secrets, but instead to an illusion of Adolin. It was still surprisingly uncomfortable for her to do it in front of someone. She'd still been telling most people that she was of the Elsecallers like Yasna, so they wouldn't know of her ability to become other people. Elokar jumped.
"Ah," he said. "Ah, that's right."
"Your Majesty," Shallan said, changing her face and body to look like that of a cleaning woman she'd sketched earlier. "I'm worried that your mission will not be as simple as you think. The letters out of Kolinar, the last ones they'd gotten, were frightened, worried things. They spoke of riots, of darkness, of Spren taking form and hurting people." Shallan changed her face to that of a soldier. "I've been preparing a team of spies," she explained, "specializing in infiltration and information gathering. I've been keeping my focus quiet, for obvious reasons. I would like to offer my services for your mission."
"I'm not certain," Elokar said hesitantly. "If Dalinar would want me taking two of his radiants away from him."
"I'm not accomplishing much for him sitting around here," Shallan said,
still wearing the soldier's face. Besides, is it his mission, or is it yours?
My mission, the king said,
then hesitated.
But let's not fool ourselves. If he didn't want you to go, I am not his subject, she said.
Nor yours yet. I'm my own woman. You tell me. What happens if you get to Kolinar and the Oath Gate is held by the enemy? Are you going to let the bridge man just fight his way in? Or might there be a better option?
She changed her face to that of a Parsh woman she had from her older sketches.
Elokar nodded, walking around her.
A team, you say? Of spies? Interesting.
A short time later, Shallan left the room carrying, tucked into her safe pouch, a formal royal request to Dalinar for Shallan's aid on the mission. Kaladin had said he felt comfortable bringing 6 people, other than a few bridgemen, who could fly on their own. Adolin and Elokar would leave room for 4 others. She tucked Elokar's request into her safe pouch, beside the letter from Marais.
I just need to be away from this place, Shallan thought. I need to be away from them and from Yasna, at least until I can figure out what I want.
A part of her knew what she was doing. It was getting harder to hide things in the back of her mind and ignore them, now that she'd spoken ideals. Instead, she was fleeing. But she could help the group going to Kolinar. And it did feel exciting, the idea of going to the city and finding the secrets there. She wasn't only running. She'd also be helping Adolin reclaim his home. Pattern hummed from her skirts, and she hummed along with him.
52. After his father. 18.5 years ago. Dalinar plodded back into camp so tired he suspected only the energy of his plate was keeping him upright. Each muggy breath inside his helm fogged the metal, which, as always, went somewhat transparent from the inside when you engaged the visor. He'd crushed the Hardassians, sending them back to start a civil war, securing the Alethi lands to the north and claiming the island of Akak. Now he'd moved southward to engage the Vaedans at the border. Herdaz had taken far longer than Dalinar had expected. He'd been out on campaign a total of 4 years now. 4 glorious years. Dalinar walked straight to his armorer's tent, picking up attendants and messengers along the way. When he'd ignored their questions, they trailed after him like kremlings eyeing a great shell's kill, waiting for their moment to snatch a tidbit. Inside the tent, he extended his arms to the sides and let the armorers start the disassembly. Helm, then arms, revealing the gambeson he wore for padding. The helm's removal exposed sweaty, clammy skin that made the air feel too cold. The breastplate was cracked along the left side, and the armorers buzzed, discussing the repair. As if they had to do something other than merely give the plate stormlight and let it regrow itself. Eventually, all that remained were his boots, which he stepped out of, maintaining a martial posture by pure force of will. Without the support of his plate, exhaustion spren began to shoot up around him like jets of dust. He stepped over to a set of travel cushions and sat down, reclining against them, sighing and closing his eyes.
"Bright Lord," one of the armorers asked, "that's where we sit."
"This is now my audience tent," Dalinar said, not opening his eyes. "Take what is absolutely essential and leave me."
The clanking of armor stopped as the workers digested what he'd said. They left in a whispering rush, and nobody else bothered him for a blissful 5 minutes, until footfalls sounded nearby. Tent flaps rustled, then leather scrunched as someone knelt beside him.
"The final battle report is here, Bright Lord," Kadash's voice.
Of course it would be one of his storming officers. Dalinar had trained them far too well.
"Speak,"
Dalinar said, opening his eyes. Kadash had reached middle age, maybe 2 or 3 years older than Dalinar.
He now had a twisting scar across his face and head from where a spear had hit him.
"We completely routed them, Bright Lord," Kadash said. "Our archers and light infantry followed with an extended harry. We slew, by best count, 2,000. Nearly half. We could have gotten more if we'd boxed them into the south."
"Never box in an enemy, Kadash," Dalinar said. "You want them to be able to retreat, or they'll fight you worse for it. A rout will serve us better than an extermination. How many people did we lose?"
"Barely 200.
Dalinar nodded. Minimal losses, while delivering a devastating blow.
"Sir," Kadash said, "I'd say this raiding group is done for.
We've still got many more to dig out. This will last years yet.
Unless the Vaden send in an entire army and engage us in force."
"They won't," Dalinar said, rubbing his forehead. "Their king is too shrewd. It isn't full-on war he wants. He only wanted to see if any contested land had suddenly become uncontested."
"Yes, Bright Lord."
"Thank you for the report. Now get out of here, and post some storming guards at the front so I can rest. Don't let anyone in, not even the Night Watcher herself."
"Yes, sir."
Kadash crossed the tent to the flaps.
Sir, you were incredible out there. Like a tempest."
Dalinar just closed his eyes and leaned back, fully determined to fall asleep in his clothing. Sleep, unfortunately, refused to come. The report set his mind to considering implications. His army had only one soulcaster for emergencies, which meant supply trains. These borderlands were expansive, hilly, and the Vadens had better generals than the Herdazians. Defeating a mobile enemy was going to be hard in such circumstances, as this first battle proved. It would take planning, maneuvering, and skirmish after skirmish to pin the various groups of Vadens down and bring them into proper battle. He yearned for those early days when their fights had been more rowdy, less coordinated. Well, he wasn't a youth anymore, and he'd learned in Herdaz that he no longer had Gavilar to do the hard parts of this job. Dalinar had camps to supply, men to feed, and logistics to work out. This was almost as bad as being back in the city, listening to scribes talk about sewage disposal. Save for one difference. Out here, he had a reward. At the end of all the planning, the strategy, and the debates with generals, came the thrill. In fact, through his exhaustion, he was surprised to find that he could sense it still. Deep down, like the warmth of a rock that had known a recent fire. He was glad that the fighting had dragged on all these years. He was glad that the Herdazians had tried to seize that land, and that now the Vadens wanted to test him. He was glad that other high princes weren't sending aid, but waiting to see what he could accomplish on his own. Most of all, he was glad that, despite today's important battle, the conflict was not over. Storms, he loved this feeling. Today hundreds had tried to bring him down, and he'd left them ashen and broken. Outside his tent, people demanding his attention were turned away one after another. He tried not to feel pleasure each time. He would answer their questions eventually, just not now. Thoughts finally released their grip on his brain, and he dipped toward slumber, until one unexpected voice jerked him out of it and sent him bolting upright. That was Evie. He leapt to his feet. The thrill surged again within him, drawn out of its own slumber. Dalinar ripped open the tent's front flaps and gaped at the blonde-haired woman standing outside, wearing a Borin hava, but with sturdy walking boots sticking out below.
"Ah," Evie said. "Husband."
She looked him up and down, and her expression soured, lips puckering.
"Has no person seen fit to order him a bath? Where are his grooms, to see him undressed properly?"
"Why are you here?" Dalinar demanded.
He hadn't intended to roar it, but he was so tired, so shocked. Evie leaned backward before the outburst, eyes opening wide. He briefly felt a spike of shame. But why should he? This was his war camp. Here he was the Blackthorn,
This was the place where his domestic life should have no purchase on him. By coming here, she invaded that. Ebby said.
Other women are at the camp. Other wives. It is common for women to go to war.
Alethi women, Dalinar snapped, trained to it from childhood and acquainted with the ways of warfare. We spoke of this, Evie, we...
He halted, looking at the guards. They shuffled uncomfortably.
Come inside, Evie, Dalinar said. Let's discuss this in private.
Very well. And the children?
You brought our children to the battlefront?
Storms, she didn't even have the sense to leave them at the town the army was using as a long-term command post.
In,
Dalinar said, pointing at the tent. Evie wilted, then scuttled to obey, cringing as she passed him. Why had she come? Hadn't he just been back to Kolinar to visit?
That had been recent, he was sure. Or maybe not so recent.
He did have several letters from Evie that Teleb's wife had read to him, with several more waiting to be read. He dropped the flaps back into position and turned toward Evie, determined not to let his frayed patience rule him.
Navani said I should come, Evie said. She said it was shameful that you have waited so long between visits. Adolin has gone over a year without seeing you, Dalinar, and little Renarin has never even met his father.
Renarin, Dalinar said, trying to work out the name.
He hadn't picked that.
Re, Evie said, from my language. Nar, after his father, in, to be born unto.
Stormfather, that was a butchering of the language.
Dalinar fumbled, trying to work through it. Nar meant like unto.
What does re mean in your language? Dalinar asked, scratching his face.
It has no meaning, Evie said. It is simply the name. It means our son's name, or him.
Dalinar groaned softly. So the child's name was like one who was born unto himself.
Delightful. You didn't answer, Evie pointed out, when I asked after a name via Spanreed.
How had Navani and Iole allowed this travesty of a name?
Storms. Knowing those two, they'd probably encouraged it.
They were always trying to get Evie to be more forceful. He moved to get something to drink, but then remembered that this wasn't actually his tent. There wasn't anything in here to drink but armor oil.
You shouldn't have come, Dalinar said. It is dangerous out here.
I wish to be a more Alethi wife. I want you to want me to be with you.
He winced.
Well, you should still not have brought the children.
Dalinar slumped down into the cushions.
They are heirs to the princedom, assuming this plan of Gavilar's with the crown lands and his own throne works out. They need to remain safe in Kolinar.
I thought you'd want to see them,
Ebby said, stepping up to him. Despite his harsh words, she unbuckled the top of his gambeson to get her hands under it and begin rubbing his shoulders. It felt wonderful. He let his anger melt away. It would be good to have a wife with him, to scribe, as was proper. He just wished that he didn't feel so guilty at seeing her. He was not the man she wanted him to be.
I hear you had a great victory today,
Evie said softly.
You do service to the king.
You'd have hated it, Evie. I killed hundreds of people. If you stay, you'll have to listen to war reports, accounts of deaths, many at my hand.
She was silent for a time.
Could you not let them surrender to you?
The Vaidens aren't here to surrender. They're here to test us on the battlefield.
And the individual men? Do they care for such reasoning as they die?
What? Would you like me to stop and ask each man to surrender as I prepare to strike him down?
Would that...
No, Evie, that wouldn't work.
Oh.
He stood up, suddenly anxious.
Let's see the boys, then.
Leaving his tent and crossing the camp was a slog. his feet feeling like they'd been encased in blocks of creme. He didn't dare slouch. He always tried to present a strong image for the men and women of the army, but he couldn't help that his padded garb was wrinkled and stained with sweat. The land here was lush compared to Kolinar. The thick grass was broken by sturdy stands of trees, and tangled vines draped the western cliff faces. There were places farther into Yakoved where you couldn't take a step without vines writhing under your feet. The boys were by Evie's wagons. Little Adolin was terrorizing one of the chulls, perched atop its shell and swinging a wooden sword about, showing off for several of the guards, who dutifully complimented his moves. He'd somehow assembled armor from strings and bits of broken rockbud shell.
Storms he's grown, Dalinar thought.
When last he'd seen Adolin, the child had still looked like a toddler, stumbling through his words. Little over a year later, the boy spoke clearly and dramatically as he described his fallen enemies. They were apparently evil flying chulls. He stopped when he saw Dalinar, then he glanced at Evie. She nodded, and the child scrambled down from the chull. Dalinar was certain he'd fall at three different points. He got down safely, walked over, and saluted. Evie beamed.
He asked the best way to talk to you, she whispered. I told him you were a general, the leader of all the soldiers. He came up with that on his own.
Dalinar squatted down. Little Adolin immediately shied back, reaching for his mother's skirts.
Afraid of me? Dalinar asked. Not unwise. I'm a dangerous man.
Daddy?
The boy said, holding to the skirt with one white-knuckled hand, but not hiding.
Yes. Don't you remember me?
Hesitantly, the motley-haired boy nodded.
I remember you. We talk about you every night when we burn prayers. So you will be safe, fighting bad men.
I'd prefer to be safe from the good ones, too, Dalinar said. Though I will take what I am offered.
He stood up, feeling... what? Shame to not have seen the boy as often as he should have? Pride at how the boy was growing? The thrill still squirming deep down. How had it not dissipated since the battle?
Where is your brother, Adolin? Dalinar asked.
The boy pointed toward a nurse who carried a little one. Dalinar had expected a baby, but this child could nearly walk, as evidenced by the nurse putting him down and watching fondly as he toddled a few steps, then sat, trying to grab blades of grass as they pulled away. The child made no sounds. He just stared, solemn, as he tried to grip blade after blade. Dalinar waited for the excitement he'd felt before upon meeting Adolin for the first time. But storms... he was just so tired.
"Can I see your sword?"
Adolin asked. Dalinar wanted nothing more than to sleep, but he summoned the blade anyway, driving it into the ground with the edge pointed away from Adolin. The boy's eyes grew wide.
"Mommy says I can't have my plate yet," Adolin said.
"Teleb needs it. You can have it when you come of age."
"Good. I'll need it to win a blade."
Nearby, Evie clicked her tongue softly, shaking her head. Dalinar smiled, kneeling beside his blade and resting his hand on the boy's shoulder.
"I'll win you one in war, son."
"No,"
Adolin said, chin up.
"I want to win my own, like you did."
"A worthy goal," Dalinar said. "But a soldier needs to be willing to accept help. You mustn't be hard-headed. Pride doesn't win battles."
The boy cocked his head, frowning.
"Your head isn't hard?"
He rapped his knuckles against his own. Dalinar smiled, then stood up and dismissed Oathbringer. The last embers of the thrill finally faded.
"It's been a long day," he told Evie. "I need to rest. We'll discuss your role here later."
Evie led him to a bed within one of her storm wagons.
Then, at last, Dalinar was able to sleep.